Wait till it goes on. Tonight it's my distinct pleasure to welcome Kojin Bohanic, a practitioner and teacher of yoga. He has been a student, teacher, and avid practitioner for over 10 years, spending the last five becoming literate in Sanskrit. How many people can say that? And so we're very much looking forward to someone who has memorized Patanjali and can speak about it both from an intellectual point of view and a practice point of view. So that's why we wanted to have him here tonight. That's why you're here tonight. Welcome, Kojin.
Thank you. All right. Well, it's a real honor to be here, and I'm glad you guys all made it out here. There's a couple things that I'd like to say before I start. First of all, I'd like to say a little something. As Rob mentioned, I have committed the Patanjali Yoga Sutras to memory in both English and in Sanskrit. Several years back, I guess about 5 or 6 years ago, I was working out in the gym, and I would do an hour of cardio before I'd do an hour of asana practice. And I found myself singing along these really terrible gym songs. And I knew the lyrics for every single song. And it kind of dawned on me how much brain space I had dedicated to all of this pretty worthless, even maybe self-destructive. And I decided right there that I was fed up and I was going to do something more useful with my brain while I was standing there doing cardio. So I started memorizing sutras as I did my cardio. And it started out that I would just memorize a couple sutras every time I would be at the gym 3, 4, 5 days a week. And then it started to take over my life, which is a great thing. Actually, I started to figure out different times, studying while driving, occasionally even reading while driving, but I hope I didn't cut any of you off in traffic on my way here. And also trying to figure out different ways of applying sutras into my just regular daily life without having to say I'm going to sit down and study 3 hours a day, but figuring out how I can recite sutras from my way to my car to work, while I'm brushing my teeth in the morning, while I'm driving to the Zendo to meditate, you know. There's many little places. So I guess what I would like to start with is I'd like to encourage you all to figure out a way of doing what we call jnana yoga, right? Knowledge of yoga of wisdom, yoga of knowledge. Figure out a scripture that inspires you and incorporate it into your daily practice. Don't have a huge goal. Let's say I'm going to memorize the Bhagavad Gita in 1 year, you know. Bhagavad Gita would probably take about 10 years the way I... But, you know, you can take a couple sutras and bring it into your daily life. So that's the first thing I would like to say, and that's how I got to know all of this. And then I started, of course, figuring out how to read and write in Sanskrit as well, because I just became passionate about it. The other thing that I would like to really encourage you is it's very important to me that you all understand what I'm putting down here. It's a lot of this is really, really heady, and some of this stuff I haven't really expressed to anybody else other than my poor wife, who has to be subjected to this stuff on a daily basis. So please, if you have any questions at all during this, raise your hand if you don't understand some of the terminology, whether it's Sanskrit, whether it's English terminology. I will be talking about some theological principles in English as well as a lot of Sanskrit too. So I really, really encourage you to not be afraid. Raise your hand. A lot of you people know me, so you guys should feel free to speak up and just, you know, if you have any questions. All right. So let's proceed. All right, so the first thing I would like to talk about is the methodology to analyze in scripture in general, but then we'll get a little bit more specific to Patanjali, all right? So one of the things that I would like to propose here is a principle of universalism, right? Universalism is a theological position that holds that all persons and creatures are related to God and to the divine, right? And therefore are sacred. So it's kind of a way of looking at all things as being sacred. The entire world is being worthy of reverence, right? This is valuable to us because it allows us to have a new perspective on life. You know, your existence is not as banal if you realize that everything is part of this really wonderful sacred event, right? All existence is to be revered. Universalism tends to emphasize universal principles of all the world's religions and accept other religions in an inclusive manner. So this has the benefit of countering dogma, right? Now, the philosophical basis that I use for universalism is what I call subordinating mythology to theology, right? When I'm speaking about mythology, I'm talking about what the specifics of the religion are, whether you're reading the Bible or the Quran or Patanjali's Yoga Sutras or the Bhagavad Gita. We would consider that the mythology, right? The theology are what are the actual ideas behind that scripture. And what you find is you find that there are similar theological positions that can be applied to every different religion. For example, I'll give you some of the definitions of some of these that are present. You know, you can find these currents. You can look at the Bible with a pantheist perspective, and then you can look at the Bhagavad Gita with a pantheist perspective, and then you can open the Quran and look at it. So this is another way of bringing all the religions together in such a way that you can respect and tolerate each other, whether Abraham lived here and when and who his sons were really doesn't become as relevant as what is this scripture actually saying, okay? So this is the approach that I like to take when I'm reading something like Patanjali or any other scripture, right? So this has also got radical implications for world peace, right? This is a way of reconciling the religions. One of our major problems in the world today is the conflict between religions. So I think this has pretty radical implications in terms of world peace, okay? So I'm going to give you some examples of some of these different theological strands. And you can think about the scriptures and what these mean and how they can be applied, right? Pantheism is a belief that God is all-encompassing, right? We'll define the term God in a little bit here because I know that carries a lot of baggage. And I've actually made the argument before that God is a semantical error. A word is only useful if people agree on the definition. If green means blue to you and purple to you and black to you, then why even use the word, right? So I've made that argument before, but then I'm going to define God in a way that, you know, hopefully there are certain things that we can agree on, all right? The universe, according to pantheism, is that there's not necessarily a creative personal deity, you know? You don't petition God with prayer. You don't say, God, this is what I need, you know, hook me up and forget about my enemies, you know? This is not the kind of theology that's present in a pantheist perspective, right? A God and the universe are essentially identical, right? Everything around you is God. This is God. The floor is God. Suffering is God, right? Starvation is God. God is present in all things, right? This is basically the idea behind pantheism, is that God interpenetrates everything, right? And is the source of truth, right? So God and truth are pretty much identical. All right, that would be a pantheist perspective. You can contrast this with the absolute monotheistic perspective. This is one that generally tends to dominate Judeo-Christianity, right? This is more of a personal deity approach to God, petitioning God, for example, thinking of God as a being that you can talk to and have a relationship, right? So the idea that God is not necessarily immanent, present in all things, that God is more transcendent, separate in some other realm, some better place, right? And we got to try to get him to help us out down here, right? This is a more absolute monotheistic perspective. Then another theological position is dualism. Dualism is the idea of a separation between spirit and matter, right? This is best embodied by the ancient Indian philosophy of Samkhya, right? And as we start getting into the sutras, we'll see how Samkhya philosophy actually became the basis for Patanjali Yoga Sutras. So Samkhya is a dualistic idea that the world can be divided into prakriti and pratyusha, right? Prakriti being matter, right? That which is tangible, and pratyusha being that which is spirit, that which is actually beyond matter, okay? So this is a dualistic perspective. Descartes also had a similar proposition as well of a division between mind and spirit. This is very common in the idea of soul, right? When we say, oh, I have a body and I have a soul, this is a dualistic perspective, all right? Monism is the idea that everything is a formless one. Everything is united and connected, right? This idea is really well supported by nuclear physics, for example, or physics and chemistry. If you guys know anything about physics, where's Chris? There he is. Wave-particle duality is an example of monism. I got a physicist in there today. If I have any questions, I'm coming to you. What's that? Oh, darn. Stuart's not good. Anyway, so monism is more of a, you know, physics perspective. The matter is not these separate compartments. They're actually waves of probability that create a fluid matrix, right? This is an idea of monism. We call that a monad. Some Indian philosophies that would really embody that would be like Advaita Vedanta, you know. In Sanskrit, we would call this monad, this universal flux. We would call this Brahman. We might call it as Patanjali calls it Ishvara, right? Then when we speak about other terms of divine, names of God, they have to do with different aspects of this monad, right?
How would you say that's different from pantheism?
It's not necessarily. Pantheism is the idea that it's alive and it's to be revered, right? And that it is God, right? Monism is the idea that it's all fluid, right? So pantheism might be more open to a more dualistic perspective, like, yeah, okay, it's all alive and it's all revered, but there's more duality. And I also want to emphasize that none of these principles necessarily contradict each other, right? They may be mutually supportive. When you put dualism and non-dualism, darn it, I didn't put non-dualism on the list. When you put them side by side, initially they look like they're contradictory, but then with enough thought, you can realize that non-dualism is not possible without dualism. I'm not going to get into that, though, because that'll blow your head off. All right. Okay, so Pythagoras had a very monist perspective, and he believed in the monad. That's just an example
of
it.
The force.
The forces are really good, like the Jedi, right? Okay, cool.
All
right. Yes, the Matrix has got a lot of elements of this. Okay, and then, of course, the last thing I want to mention is the process of self-realization. I think that several people in this room probably are familiar with this concept, right? The Sanskrit terminology for this would be atma-jnana, jnana being knowledge, atma-self, self-knowledge, right? Or atma-darsana, which would be the vision of the self, right? The idea behind self-realization is that you're recovering your authentic identity as a transcendental reality rather than your identity as a separate nature, right? Many of you guys who take my yoga class know that in the end of class we talk about samadhi and releasing duality and separation. You guys have heard me say that a million times, right? Well, this is a process of self-realization. This is the idea that you are much more than a limited individual self, isolated from the rest of the world, that you're actually part of this giant flux, this giant matrix, this giant nexus of existence that is divine and to be revered. So you might call it God, you might call it Brahman, all right? I want to make a point here about the word ego. Usually when we're speaking in Eastern philosophy, we talk about ego not in a Freudian sense. Ego, the way, is usually referred to meaning separate identity, right? This is very different than how Freud used it, and it's come to be the dominant term, use of the term ego. So if you guys have any questions about how I'm using the term ego, I'd be happy to answer that. So the process of self-realization is not simply cognitive. It's not simply experimental. It's actually a fundamental, radical shift at the root of your conscience, right? You can understand this all in theory. Like right now what we're doing is we're saying, oh yeah, that makes sense. Does that mean you've really gone through the process of self-realization? Not necessarily, right? This is what I would call meta-rational or meta-intellectual. A lot of times this gets classified as anti-intellectual, and they call it anti-intellectual because this is the realization that intellectualism has its limit, and there's a point where intellectual knowledge stops being useful, and it's time for something else to take over. This is process of self-realization. Oftentimes the word enlightenment is a really terrible word in English. It just means this much. But a lot of times 15 different Sanskrit words all get bunched together as enlightenment. And oftentimes when we speak of enlightenment, we're talking about self-realization. So basically what I want to get from all of this is the idea that these theological principles can be applied or rejected and put into or looked at and seen in every different religion. Just because you are a Christian and you happen to be absolute monotheists doesn't mean that you could not be a Christian and reject absolute monotheism and take a more pantheist perspective. Also, you could have a Jain who's like has a philosophy, Anekatavada, many-sidedness, who would look at all religions from all these perspectives and see equal truth in all of them. So basically, this is a way of justifying universalism. Right. Oh, and I'm sorry. Maybe it's important to note that a lot of times Patanjali Yoga Sutras gets classified as dualistic, right? But you might guess by my thesis, this is only one way of looking at Patanjali. George Forestine, who I would never take issue with because he's such a great figure in this whole school, his book right there, The Encyclopedia of Yoga on the shelf, says Patanjali is dualistic, and that's why it didn't make as much of an impression on Indian culture as did the Bhagavad Gita or some of the other scriptures, because it rejected traditional Advaita, which is more of a pantheist or a monistic. So anyway, I see the dualistic perspectives in Patanjali, but I see it in all of this as well. Okay, so more on methodology. I would just like to say two more things. One of them is what I call cafeteria spirituality, right? I was in a in a church, a very fundamentalist born-again Christian church in Florida with my wife's family, and the reverend gets up there and he's pounding on that podium, you know, saying, "This is not cafeteria philosophy. We can't just take what we like from the Bible and reject the rest." And I sat there and I said, "That's a great idea. That's awesome." And then he said, "Don't read the, what was it, the Da Vinci Code." And then I bought that book afterwards. So I pretty much did everything he said not to. So cafeteria spirituality, great concept. This is spirituality for critical thinkers, people who reject the idea of uncritical faith, right? The idea that you have a good brain and for a reason, and it's to be used, right? Don't just accept piecemeal what is handed to you, right? That's basically the idea behind what I would call cafeteria spirituality. I think that the best way to weaken a religion is to stop thinking about it critically, all right? When you get the masses of people following your religion is uncritical thinkers who are just blind followers, that's the best way to weaken a religion. So really, I think that it's not a challenge to a religion to think critically about it and to attack it. That which is true will rise to the surface. That which is untrue will dissipate, okay? So it's very important to criticize it. We have a saying in Sanskrit, satyameva jayateṁ, right? Have you guys heard this maybe? All right, this is often quoted by Gandhi. It means truth alone prevails, never untruth, right? So this is the idea that when you're presented with information, go on the offense, you know? Just go ahead and attack it, because what will happen is you'll figure out where its weaknesses are and where its strength is, because the truth will be left standing. So this is a very important principle, critical thinking, essentially. I also would like to point out that there are several Patanjali Yoga Sutras that I do not agree with, and some that I question, right? One of the ones that I think of is Sauchatsunga Jagupsa Pradira Samsargaha. It means, from physical purity arises disgust for one's own body and disinclination to come into physical contact with others. Not something I aspire to. From physical purity, I want to hug other people and love them, right? Okay, so this is one that I kind of go, huh, that's kind of whacked. Oh, well. Let's, like, leave that over there with the mashed potatoes and gravy and, you know what I mean by cafeteria, help yourself to whatever you want. Anyway, so, and then there's also various vibhutis, right? This might also be, some of you may know this as siddhi, right? There's extraordinary powers, like suddenly I'm going to levitate across the room and that kind of thing. I can't really say that this corresponds with any of my experience I've had in this life, so I pretty much reject that. But at the same time, this leads me to my next point, principle of charity, right? Principle of charity is we should have the self-assurance to be able to question something critically, but we should also have the humility to be able to think that it's possible that maybe we just don't understand it, right? So be tenuous about how you reject information, right? Don't just say, "Oh, that doesn't make sense, a bunch of garbage," you know? Look into it. Put it in your mind. And also there's quite a big possibility that something could be lost in the translation, which I think brings... No, that's that point. Okay, so then we'll go to the next one. One thing that when you're approaching the study of Eastern scriptures, very important to try to let go of our Judeo-Christian notions, right? What we say in faith, you say in a Southern Baptist church, means something completely different in Patanjali Yoga Sutras, mm-hmm. right?
That's faith. The word for faith.
Shraddha. Oftentimes it's translated as meaning what is in your heart, right? What you know, what is your life experiences have told you is true, and then you act on that, and you don't have to think about it, because this is what, you know, I woke up every morning for the last 31 years, I'm probably going to wake up tomorrow morning. I have a fair amount of faith that that's going to happen. But it's also important to note that the opposite of faith is not doubt. The opposite of faith is certainty. All right. When we generally define faith in the East, it's like, "Oh, I'm certain I have faith. I know there's God. I know the Bible's true. I have faith." Right? This is not necessarily the way it's interpreted in the East. In the East, the opposite of faith is certainty. Faith is used when you don't know what happens after death. What is beyond my mind? What is this nature of my soul? I'm just going to go forth with inquiry, right? So faith has more of an inquisitive connotation as opposed to a dogmatic certainty. Okay, so that's just faith, right? God, I spoke a little bit about. You can look at God in any of those theological ways. I'm not going to overgo with that. And then I'm on the wrong page. And then also, it's very important to note that in Sanskrit, the word satya, which means truth, also is a synonym for God, right? So from a Hindu, from a Sanskrit perspective, God is truth. 1 + 1 = 2, that's an expression of God because it's true, right? So an atheist from a Sanskrit perspective is somebody who has no interest in the truth, right? So atheism is almost, I don't know how to say this without being too abrasive, but atheism is almost the bastard child of Christianity. Like, it's very much accepts the same premises and the same definitions of God and the same definition of faith as Christianity. So in some ways it's a relative of Christianity, right? The way most people understand atheism. If you define the way God is defined, if you change the way God is defined is to mean truth, then it's almost impossible to be an atheist, right? And the reason why God is truth is that's to say that that which is true is to be revered and respected, right? Okay? Is that pretty clear? I know it's kind of weird and a little bit fuzzy. Do you guys have any questions on that? All right. Feel free. Right. And I like to argue, too, so if anyone wants to ruffle my feathers, yes, please.
A lot of what you're presenting is I need to really get my head to go pretty fast.
Yeah.
So my request is if you would pause between some of
your thoughts. All right. Gotcha. Somebody should have a pause card and they could just hold it up. All right, so we're going to pause from there.
As a student of coaching in a completely different context, I can say that pausing and going slow are not among his greatest skills.
Well, let me tell you what all my other teachers say about this. So the very last thing that I would like to say before we actually get into Patanjali is the idea that there is no English equivalent for Sanskrit terminologies. You cannot take one Sanskrit word and translate it into one English word with pretty much any concept. Some Sanskrit concepts, just to understand the word, could take you years and years and years of study. Like the word shraddha, faith, for example. Years of study to figure out where it's used in every different context and every different connotation. So really, the way to approach this is to start developing a bit of a Sanskrit terminology. We all know what the word karma means, right? It's a word that has managed to come into our culture, right? It's not so hard to do, you know? So just, you know, be open to the idea that I'm actually going to use a bit of Sanskrit tonight. I'm going to try not to bog people down, but I really think that that's the only way to really approach this. There are some really good books out there on Patanjali Yoga Sutras. The bad ones are the ones that don't use any Sanskrit, and they try to make an English equivalent for the word, so they end up like amalgamating six different words together, and it becomes, you know, why not just learn the Sanskrit? So anyway, I guess that's my disclaimer. But it's much easier than saying, you know, mind, consciousness, thought, form, process, impression. You know, like, what does that mean? Just use the word samskara, you know? So, anyway, so, let's...
Now we all agree about what karma is.
No, probably not. But we have a certain shared idea, I'm sure, that we have. Okay, or maybe not. Maybe it's a word that's still easy to find. Okay, let's go on, move on to the next one. Historical context of Patanjali, all right? So, I'm going to go into a bit of the history and the significance of Patanjali's Yoga Sutras in terms of yoga, right? This is a really, really critical contribution that Patanjali made to the school of yoga. Actually, I wasn't ready for that one yet, but thanks. I knew you were going to do that at that slide, too. I knew you were going to do that. All right, so it's not clear exactly when Patanjali Yoga Sutras were composed. It's not entirely clear who Patanjali is. There's a couple different people named Patanjali, and they're not sure if they're all the same person. But it's likely that it was composed around 200 BCE to 200 CE, somewhere in between there. Probably going more towards the BCE side of things, okay? So that's when it is. That's about 200, 250 years after Buddha, right? Okay? And one of my theses is that it's a form of early Buddhism as well. So anyway, that's not going to be this lecture, though. I already mentioned that it's predicated upon Samkhya philosophy, the dualistic separation between spirit and matter, right? This is a really, really strong theme, this separation between spirit and matter, and this is the dualism that Feuerstein was referring to, okay? But you can interpret Patanjali from many different theological perspectives, as I was saying earlier, okay? So, let's talk about the history of yoga really quick. So yoga is at least 3,000 years old. I mean, that's a pretty conservative estimate. It could be many, many times older.
Can you explain what you mean by yoga?
Yes, we'll get to that. Well, I'm actually going to define yoga by Patanjali's terms in a bit. But
3,000 years ago.
Let me go through this. So in India, Indus civilization, that's about 3,300 to 1,700 BCE, they found ancient seals in the Indus Valley city, civilization that depict figures in meditation-like postures, you know, just cross-legged and quietly like this. Then there's the Brahmanas, which are about 900 to 500 BCE. They reference a practice called tapas. Tapas is an austerity, right? A way of purifying yourself for ritual by performing austerity such as fasts and abstaining from sex, various things like this. This is considered to be a fundamental yoga practice. So some of these practices go back to the Brahmanas, right? The Ayurveda, which is one of the oldest scriptures, is also makes reference to tapas, to austerities as well that are essential to yogic practices. And then there's Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, speaks about meditation, sannyasa, renunciation, right? It's very beautiful. One of my favorite Upanishads. Taittiriya Upanishad was the very first to use the word yoga. It dates to somewhere in the second millennium BCE, somewhere between 2000 and 1000 BCE. And then the word starts to actually really congeal a little bit more in the Mahabharata. You know, one of the chapters in the Mahabharata is the Bhagavad Gita. People are probably more familiar with this story of Krishna and Arjuna on the battlefield, right? I think people who would come to an event like this are familiar with the Bhagavad Gita at least a little bit, right? Okay, anyway. In Bhagavad Gita, this is an important point. In Bhagavad Gita, they refer to yoga as Samkhya Yoga, right? So the school of thought, Samkhya, and the school of yoga are still the same school of thought, right? Now, this is where Patanjali has a significant contribution. Patanjali Yoga Sutra, 200 to 300 BCE, is the first point where yoga actually becomes one of its own separate schools of what we call Astika Hindu philosophy, Orthodox Hindu philosophy. So at this point, with that's basically probably one of the main contributions of Patanjali, is that he separates, not only is he predicated upon Sankhya, but he also separates it and creates an entirely new system, right? I also would argue that the other six elements of Orthodox Hinduism are also represented in Patanjali as well. So he was a very well-read scholar who knew all the fields of philosophy of the day, including Buddhism, perhaps Jainism as well. This is one of my theses that I would like to work on, is to find all the elements of this in Patanjali. And he pretty much put it together and synergized it into a new school of yoga. Okay? So, go ahead. So it's really kind of cool. In terms of periodization, Patanjali is like Jesus, right? Jesus, you have before Christ and after Christ, B.C., A.D., right? In yogic eras, we speak about pre-classical, classical, and post-classical. Pre-classical is anything before Patanjali. Classical is Patanjali. Post-classical is everything after Patanjali, right? So it's just kind of significant to see how yogic periods are really oriented around Patanjali's work, okay?
Can you go back to that? Because you claim that Patanjali is not necessarily dualistic, but the classical period there you mentioned is characterized by dualism.
Yeah.
So
yeah. Patanjali is dualistic. Okay. But I don't, and it may even be dominantly dualistic, but there are elements of pantheism in
but
other.
But you would acknowledge that it's more a dualist.
Yeah, yeah. I'm gonna go along with Feuerstein on that. I'm gonna have a hard time taking that guy on. He's a pretty smart guy. But at the same time, I can go through it and find pantheistic elements of it. Just the very term yoga, to union, to bring together, that implies a monad, right? Which is a very interesting thesis, is how Samkhya, the dualism of Prakriti and Purusa, and the term yoga, union, as a monad, how these two terms can be reconciled, right?
But yoga is a dualistic term because it implies there are two things to be united.
Yes, but there's also a monad that is united, the unity itself. Right? This is where I said earlier, dualism is an essential component of non-dualism. Remember I said that earlier, but it's a hard thing to talk about because this gets meta-rational. This gets beyond the limitations.
In the practice of yoga, you're never striving to achieve separation of mind and body or spirit.
Generally not. Generally,
self-realization.
Yeah, you're not usually trying to weed out the mind from the body, but at the same time, what the things that Patanjali does talk about, a really strict separation between Prakriti and Purusa, a strict separation between purusa and sattva, and he does talk about things as being very strictly separate.
But when they're strictly separate, there's no life. Excuse me? There's no... I mean, life requires that they come together.
Anyway, things are separate. I mean, we can all see that. Like, I can't hear what's in George's head right now. I can't hear what's in your head. So we're separate, right? But you cut off the oxygen in this room, we all die. We're all the same, right? So it's a qualified sort of separateness. Yes, things are separate. No, things are not separate. Both are true. Okay? All right. Let's hit a new slide before we transcend our consciousness over here. All right. So here's Branches of Yoga. Too bad you can't see this really little picture I found online. It's got nothing to do with yoga, but it was just something. It had all these like different aspects of life, like, you know, active practices, and it was just like a real, like, this is how to holistically live. Anyway, it has nothing to do with this, but these are generally accepted as the schools of yoga, right? We have karma, which is social and political actions. Gandhi is considered one of the greatest karmic yogis of all time. Dr. King, Mother Teresa, my wife, all of these people are great karmic yogis, right? All right. Jnana, what we're doing tonight is jnana, right? We're talking, we're philosophizing, all right? Bhakti, devotion, this is like, do you think Hare Krishna is Gaudiya Vaishnavism, singing, dancing, chanting, telling stories of Krishna's childhood. This is all bhakti. It's not really that rational, but it feels good, and it may be the most comprehensive approach to divine through love, right? Because you're not limited by rational faculties. Love is boundless, right? So this is a very good approach to divine. Hatha is generally physical practice, right? What we do with our body. I'm going to say something about Hatha in just a second. And Raja. Patanjali's classical yoga is generally considered Raja yoga. So I'm going to talk a little bit about Hatha and Raja in just a second.
Aren't there other branches of yoga?
Like what? I mean,
tantric?
Yeah, tantric would be... Hatha is generally considered to be a part of tantric, tantra, because it incorporates the body. I don't know a lot about that, so I'm not going to talk about areas. Tantra is one of those things that I cannot figure out, no matter how many books I read about it, no matter how many times I look it up, I still can't give you a definition of what tantra is. I know we got tantras and yantras and mantras, and I don't know. I don't know enough about it to speak about it. Yeah, not that I haven't read about it, but it's one of those things that I think you have to like be from the Himalayas to figure out what tantra is. I don't know. Anyway, any more? Okay. Moving on. So I want to talk about Hatha yoga. Most people don't know that the word Hatha actually translates to forceful, right? People would probably think that it translates into gentle, but no, that's not actually the case. It also comes from Hatha implies sun and moon as well. But it's contrasted with Mridu yoga, which is gentle yoga. And the scriptures that did this actually were... It was very controversial when Hatha yoga started coming around, 15th century Hatha yoga Pradipika and some of these early Hatha yoga scriptures. Some of the conventional yogis at the time were like, what are you going to do sitting with your legs all twisted up for 6 hours? Are you crazy? That's too forceful. And one of the arguments that was used in Jiva Mukti Viveka, which is an old scripture, was... There's two ways of bringing a horse into the stable. One is to lead it with grass, and the other is to whip it. Hatha yoga is like whipping it into the stable. So this is like this big thing. Hatha's crazy. We shouldn't do Hatha yoga, right? But then eventually it became more and more accepted. And the idea that using the body is a physical vehicle to the spirit became a very dominant idea. And, you know, the resistance against Hatha pretty much started to dwindle. Then it became a matter of how forceful should our Hatha be. People in my class know how forceful I like my Hatha. It's Hatha yoga is generally considered to be a stairway to Raja yoga, right? You use the body to get to the spirit. Raja yoga is developing the spirit and the mind, right? Hatha yoga is getting the body in the necessary condition to be ready for it. That's why we do meditation at the end of class, right? We prepare our body. Technically, the class starts after you're done with your asana practice. That's when the meditation. I wish we could do hour-long meditations, but I don't know, you guys might get a little restless. So, this is the view that I advocate. Use the body as a vehicle to the spirit, okay? And then Raja Yoga, this is the scriptures of Patanjali, right? It's basically the idea of cultivating the mind as a vehicle for meditation. The term Raja Yoga was not a term that was used by Patanjali. It was not a term that was used until the 15th century Hatha Yoga Pradipika, when Hatha Yoga started getting popular, and they said, oh, that other stuff, that's Raja Yoga. we're talking about Hatha. So it was the Hatha yoga people who actually came up with the term Raja to describe Patanjali's teachings, that which came before, right? So the term Raja can be translated into king, right? Like Raj, you know, like the British Raj in India, the king, the ruler. And this could be taken to mean a couple things. It could mean your mind is the king and the ruler of your body, right? So we access the mind. We use the body to access the ruler, which is the mind. Or you can think of it as the king of yogas, you know, as being, because of its potential to cultivate the state of Kaivalya, which is yet another word that's used, defined as enlightenment, okay? So this is one of the benefits of Raja Yoga, is developing this state called Kaivalya, right? Not for this lecture, sorry. Okay, moving on.
What's your definition of mind?
Oh, this is a good question. Let's see, is that my next one? Mind, this is a good testimony to the complexity of Sanskrit theology, psychology. There's many different words for mind in Sanskrit. We have manas, buddhi, chitta. These are three I think of off the top of my head. We're going to come to that question in just a second when we get to the first sutra. Okay, so let's hold that for a second. Are we at the first sutra? Oh, I'm at the second sutra. First sutra is Atta Yoga Nishasanam. Herein lies an exposition on the teaching of yoga. Pretty, isn't it? Okay, that's all for that slide. All right, so what is yoga according to Patanjali? All right, I think we had this question. This also addresses what is mind, okay? Patanjali says, yoga is chitta vritti nirodha. Yoga is the cessation of the modification of the mind. This is probably the most famous of Patanjali's sutras, other than the Ashtangas, right? This is one of the things that you always, any elementary book on yoga is going to say, well, Patanjali says yoga is the cessation of the modification of the mind. There's a really great quote by Swami Satchidananda here, though I might disagree a little bit with him on asana practice, if I may be so bold. I really like the way he explains this. All right. Every thought, feeling, perception, or memory you have causes a modification or a ripple in the mind. It distorts and colors the mental mirror. If you can restrain the mind from forming into modifications, there will be no distortion and you will experience your true self. All right. So the idea is that the mind is a lot like a pond, right? You keep throwing rocks in the pond, you're not going to see the bottom of the pond because the water's all rippled up, right? Stop throwing rocks in the pond, and then you can see the bottom, your higher self. Okay? Is that pretty clear? Is that enough pause? We should take actually an hour of meditation on that. But all right. All right. So to understand the sutra, I'm going to define the basic terms here. We got yoga, citta, vritti, nirodha. Okay. So what is yoga, right? Yoga, it comes from a word yuge, which means to yoke, to harness, to team, to bring together, conjunction. I keep wishing that I had one of my kids' students here because they're so cute. Every class I ask them, where does yoga come from? India. What does yoga mean? Union. Yeah. What does union mean? Bringing two things together. What two things we bring together? Mind and body. And then they keep going on and they recite the whole Ashtangas and everything. These kids are brilliant. My kids' students, I'm sorry, adult students, know more about yoga philosophy than most of my adult students. This just becomes a game with us. So they're really adorable. Anyway, one of these times I'm going to have to give a lecture with one of my kids. And anyway, so union means to bring two things together, right? Or union or conjunction, all right? Basically, yoga is largely characterized by controlling the mind, right, and the senses, right? The mind, generally referring to manas, which is lower mind, right? The mind that's in charge of, like, go get food. Ugh, go get water, you know, like your base sensory sort of like things, right? That's your manas, right? Lower mind. And then indriya is your sense perception. So yoga is really concerned with control of those things right there. Okay. I'm not finished at all. I just turned the page. Okay. Chitta is a really interesting word, to me at least, and I'm kind of a nerd that way. But chitta means like mind or consciousness. It's a past participle of the word chit, to be conscious, and a lot of this kind of connotes, I used to think connotates, but it's actually connote is the word, right? Okay. It connotes awareness, right? So chit, when you're talking about mind, you're talking about that which has the capacity to be aware, right? Okay, it's generally used as an umbrella for a variety of internal processes, right? It's also considered chit, is like an individual manifestation of chitti, which is universal consciousness. Back to pantheism, right? Pantheism is the idea that everything is God. God is in everything. God is consciousness. Everything is this chitti, this consciousness. There's what we have with our chitta, our individual mind, is basically taking a cup of water out of the ocean of universal consciousness. I just made that up on the spot. That's pretty good. Yeah, I probably read it somewhere. Anyway, that's what chitta is. Chitta is an individual manifestation of a more larger universal chitti, universal consciousness. All right. So mind is not just the thing that's inside your head. Okay. So it's some points on Patanjali psychology here. Is chitta is considered to be suffused with subconscious activators or subliminal impressions called samskaras, right? This is like collective unconscious in a Freudian sense, right? That which happened to you as a kid creates an impression in your subconscious, directs how you behave early on or later on in life, right? This is a very yogic perspective. This is called samskaras, right? Samskaras come together as vasanas. Vasanas are your personality traits, right? So all those things that happen as a kid create this personality trait. All these personality traits create vritti, right? Vritti is the actual pebbles being thrown into the water, right? The churning of the mind, right? So you guys see how this works?
Is vasana, I'm not familiar with that. Is that related to the gunas at all? Or is it more...
It's probably related to the gunas in a way that I can't think of right now, but generally gunas is a subdivision of prakriti and pradusa, right? We have the division between spirit and matter is subdivided into gunas. Gunas are oftentimes talked about in terms of doshas, which are kind of the pit of...
But manas is considered prakriti, not...
Yes, I would say that. And pradusa is probably more like buddhi, but Patanjali specifically says the separation of buddhi and pradusa, right? So he believes... The Buddha is your higher mind, Purusa is your spirit, but they're still separate in Patanjali, the way he talks about them. But that does not necessarily mean that they're not conjoined as well.
So what are vasanas?
Vasana personality traits. Yeah. What side of the bed do you like to sleep on? You know, what do you like in your coffee? You know, personality traits. Just generally ways of acting, you know. So this is my understanding of it. I don't have a really super deep understanding of that, so that's...
Okay.
Where I'm going to leave that, okay? I don't want to talk about something.
Spell things out with six.
Yeah, no, this is good. Please ask questions. My most important thing is, if this is the only slide we talk about tonight, that's fine. I just want you guys to understand. That's all. That's all. I got to get this off my chest. It's not about you. All right. So, yoga, union, mind, and vritti. Vritti is a whirl, a vortex, circular activity, right? Like I said, this is the rocks that were thrown into the still pond, right? You're supposed to still the vrittis, right? It's like a continual, your mind is in this constant, continual churning, right? It's always going, always going. In meditation, we seek to still this, right? Let me think of what we say in the meditation in class. We talk about, like usually in the dhyana section, you know, I say thoughts dissipate, mind becomes clear, right? This is what we're talking about, still in vrittis, right? Vrittis embroil the psyche into what we call avidya, is delusion, right? So the constant churning of the mind actually keeps you from perceiving reality as it is and keeps you in this constant polarity of subject-object separation. Subject-object separation, and you never get to see the fluid matrix that is true existence, right? Or essential quality of existence, at least. Okay? They generate samskaras, right? So it's a cyclical nature, right? We said samskaras, the subconscious activates your vasanas, which create vritti. Well, vrittis also go back and create the samskaras. So what I said is not necessarily hierarchy, it's kind of a circle, you know, the psychology. Am I making sense? Okay. All right, so... Yes, please. No, please.
I just want to get, before you go on. Uh-huh.
I'm going into Niroda right now. Okay, Niroda, Niroda, Nir, is like, Niroda means restriction or cessation. This is akin to, is the same root, Nir, is Nirvana, right? Nirvana means to extinguish, right? You're extinguishing suffering in Buddhism, right? Well, Niroda is you're extinguishing the churning of the mind, all right? So basically, yoga is a cessation of the modification of the mind, right? Mind meaning chitta, vritti meaning this. So I think we've pretty much defined these terms.
What is rodha?
Sorry?
Rodha, if you divide up the ni and the rodha.
I'm not sure.
Not the second half of the word. The second half of the word, yeah.
Good question. It might come to me.
Okay.
Not coming. All right. Yes?
One way of understanding the rodha is third noble tree.
Yes, yes, it is definitely...
That puts it in that context.
Yes, yes. And then Martika would be the fourth. This is also part of my thesis that I will be developing later, is the similarities between Buddhism and... Yeah, very good point. Very good point. Also, Martika, right? The path, right? This is the same as Eightfold Path we have here as well, right? So we also have Martika. Dukkha, I'm going to talk about dukkha, first noble truth, is also present. I'm going to come across that in a second. As this tradition, upadana, samudya, right, this is all present in Patanjali. So one of my theses is that Patanjali is actually early Buddhism, right? So it's kind of a cool thought. Not to say it's the same as Buddhism, but there are definitely Buddhist, strong Buddhist elements in this. Okay? So are we cool with the second sutra? Yoga chitta vritti
niroda. Just to clarify, because I may have misunderstood when you first started, but yoga chitta vritti nirodaha, mm-hmm. what we're stilling is the chitta, not just the manas. We talked about manas mm-hmm. being the I need to eat. But if this was just about manas, the sutra would be yoga manas vritti nirodaha, which it's not. So it's about the whole psychic instrument called chitta.
Yes, you're not stilling the chitta, you're stilling the vritti,
right,
which is within the chitta.
Right.
Yes, yes.
Because it's not just that we're working with just the manas in this yoga.
Yes, yes. It's a specific aspect of this. Yeah, it could be your buddhi as well, right?
Because the term I've heard is the psychic instrument, which yeah. contains all of those pieces.
All right. An important thing to note here is samadhi. I define this with my 10-year-olds as high meditation, right? It seems just the easiest way to say it. In samadhi, we have different levels according to Patanjali. And one of the first ones is vitarka samadhi. Vitarka sampragnata samadhi and vitarka asampragnata samadhi. This is rational thought. So one of the very first levels in samadhi, actually the first level of samadhi, you're still in your rational mind. You still have this vritti going on, right? But then you slowly let go of the vritti, let go of the rational thought. Because, I mean, something had to bring you in the door here tonight. And likely, maybe it was your heart. Maybe you were just like, I am magnetically attracted here. Probably you read a book that made sense to you, and somehow in your mind, your vitarka, your rational mind, said, okay, this is interesting. I'm going to go in. And then eventually we let go of the rational, and this is why it becomes meta-rational or meta-intellectual, because the intellectual mind has its point. Am I answering your question?
Yes.
All right. Anything else? Second Yoga Sutra? Yoga Sutra Vritti Niroda? Okay. Oh. So, the question is, why is it that the fluctuation of the mind is not conducive to understanding the higher state of consciousness? What is it about this fluctuating mind that actually inhibits our ability to understand true reality and true nature? Okay. Here's a good sutra that illustrates this point. China vrittira bijatasya vamanir grahitir grahana grahisu tatsta tadanya janata samapati. Alright? This is the sutra. In the case of one whose chitta vrittis, mental modifications, have been almost annihilated, fusion or entire absorption in one another of the, this is important, cognizer, cognition, and cognized, is brought about as in the case of a transparent jewel resting on a colored surface. This is really cool sutra in so many ways. One of the reasons why is because it tells us how grammar is actually allegorical to the philosophy, right? When we have grammar and we speak grammatically, and I don't know a lot about Sanskrit grammar. I'm literate in that I can read and I have a vocabulary, but grammar, you know, not so literate, okay? But here in grammar we divide subject and object relation, right? Grahitir grahana. Cognizer, cognition, grahiso, cognized, right? So you're actually speaking about things in different ways as they are in reality, right? It's kind of an interesting thing. I never thought in English class that we were talking about God, you know, when we were talking about subject and object and conjugate. It never occurred to me that we were talking about the essential nature of reality You know, to me, we were doing something kind of annoying and boring and pointless. But actually, that's what's happening in grammar, in Sanskrit grammar, right? They're making a play here between subject and object. So we talked about manas, right? This lady over here is talking about lower mind, right? Our sensory mind, ugh, eat food, ugh, get water, right? And then we have buddhi, higher consciousness. Maybe I should meditate today before I go get food, right? Okay, so this is our this is our higher mind, buddhi, right? Okay, so we can't really know our buddhi, our subconscious or higher mind, when we're creating a subject-object relationship within it, right? Entire absorption of cognizer, cognition, and cognize. Cognizer would be the subject. I am the cognizer. Cognized would be the subject. I, the cognizer, am cognizing the chair, right? I'm thinking about the chair. And cognition would be the triplicity of reality, which is something that's not much talked about, would be the medium in which this is transpiring, the subject-object relation. So when your chitta's vritti have been annihilated or almost annihilated, your cognizer, cognition, and cognize, the perspective of subject and object has now merged together, right? Yes, there's a subject and object. I'm over here, the chair I'm cognizing is over there. But they are also merged. You suddenly become aware of how they're actually the same part of that monad that we were talking about way back in the beginning, right? Okay, we're both Brahman, right? I'm Kojin, I have Jiva, right? I have my own individual soul and spirit. Hopefully I'm a little bit more complex than this chair. But, thank you. But we're essentially part of the same Brahman, right? So as long as we're creating a subject-object relationship, you cannot fully become aware of your higher mind and become aware of Brahma, of the essence. I should be using this Vrata, actually. Too much term. Sorry. Okay. So this manifest world cannot simply be seen as a duality between subject and object. It can be seen as a triplicity, subject, object, and the medium in which they explain. Right? I made that point.
What would be the word for that?
For which?
What's the word for cognizer cognition?
Grahitir grahana grahyaso.
So grahana is... Yeah.
Like you can think of like a parigraha or a satyagraha, right? Force. Grahana is... I'm not going to go too far on that because I'm not really sure what the etymology of that is. But that's the grammar behind that, okay? So basically, when you're obliterating the subject-object relation, you're getting rid of the fictive separateness, right? Like, yes, we're separate, but on a more fundamental level, I keep talking in this chair, there's somebody sitting there, but on a more fundamental level, we're actually the same, right? Wave-particle duality, right? You can't find an electron. You can't put your finger on an electron and say, this is an electron. Those little models that they gave you in high school chemistry class were a big lie. 1905, correct me if I'm wrong, Chris, Einstein made a name for himself by proving wave-particle duality, and that's the idea that an electron is like a particle, but it's also like a wave of probability. You can never figure out where it occupies. It's this flux, right? This is the monad, right? This chair is really actually part of me, okay? Anyway, it's pretty metaphysical. Actually, that's physical, so anyway. So essentially, the universe is a process where the non-dual reality, consciousness, is perceived as a duality, subject-object relation, and their relationship is a triplicity, subject, object, and the medium that unites us all. Okay? Am I clear about this? But we tend to spend our time perceiving a duality in a strict subject-object relationship, and this distracts us from knowing consciousness for what it truly is, a fluid matrix. All right? Have I made that point clear? Hopefully you guys might have a little bit of background in this kind of idea, too. This is also a process of self-realization. I am the chair. Okay. Anyway, I'm about to have my silent pause moment here, so let's give this. All right. We will read this, and then we will pause. Thus, yoga is essentially a profound experience of interconnectedness, which seeks, through the stilling of the mind, to transcend the limitations of subject, object, and separation in general into a direct perception of existence as a conscious nexus. This pretty much summarizes everything I said tonight. Okay. Think about it. All right. I got it.
That's what I'm thinking about, asking about, and it has to do with having the intellectual knowledge that there are these three aspects, but the experience of having your separate sense of self disappear and you just become everything in the room or everything, wherever it is you are, there's no, it seems like even that third aspect, the medium is gone also. Is that what he's saying in this?
Yeah. It's the emergence of the three. It's the emergence of the three. Subject, object, and medium all become part of the same thing. Yeah. Probably a little bit more medium than subject. No, well, I'm not sure that makes sense.
And that is a goal.
that's an outcome. That's an outcome. Yeah, maybe a goal. Yeah.
How would you define nexus?
Interconnected web. Completely interconnected to the point where there is no separation. This is an ecological perspective, right? Mm-hmm. You know, like this is Gaia theory, right? The world is this one being, right? And we're like the liver cells or the cancer cells or something in this big giant being, right? Okay. All right. I think I got about 5 minutes here to try to burn through the other 195 sutras. So let's get on with it. All right. Thank you.
Do you have a favorite sutra?
I have a lot of favorite. The one that comes to mind right now is. Actually, that's a good question. The one that comes to mind right now is one that I've been using in our final meditation a lot lately. Samadhi Siddhi Ishvara Pranidhana. Right? Ishvara is a word we could call God in a pantheist perspective. The idea that everything is sacred, right, and is to be revered, and the whole world is God, right? This is Ishvara, right? Samadhi Siddhi Samadhi, we're just going to call that high meditation for right now. Accomplishment of Samadhi by resigning to Ishvara. Ishvara Pranidhana. This is one of the niyamas for you guys who are familiar with Ashtangas, right? This is a self-surrender to this God. So self-surrender to the nexus or the God or the force or Ishvara or whatever you want to call it, to the idea that everything is this conscious being. This is very important because this is what is dissipating the subject-object relationship, right? This is Ishvara Pranidhana. So Patanjali lays out this huge process for how to achieve this state that we're talking about, right? This experiential state, and maybe even deeper than experience. He's got the Ashtangas, he's got the Yamas, Niyamas, he's got all this ways. And then all of a sudden he says, or you could just go Ishvara Pranidhana. You could just do it by surrendering to it. So that's one of my favorites. Viveka Kyatarabhi Plavahanopaya. Gosh, I'm not going to try that one. I have a couple other ones. This is the only one that sounds good in English. Knowledge of its own true nature through cognition, self-cognition is obtained when consciousness assumes the form which does not pass from place to place. Right? This goes along with the question of how do we stop the churning of the mind. Right? You become aware of cognition, citta, citti, universal consciousness, by stilling the mind. That's basically what that sutra means. But it's just so beautiful. I really can't describe to you guys what it's like to have 196 sutras bouncing around in my head all day long. It's a great feeling. It's a great feeling. It serves better than stupid gym radio music, right? You know, I go to the Zendo and I meditate in the morning for 2 hours. And the sutra will just come into my mind. And I'll go, what does this mean? How does this apply to what I'm doing? It's like just constantly getting rid of all the, you know, it's just nice to have something positive running through your mind. Something to think about. I don't know. I really highly recommend this. Is what we call svadhyaya. Self-study, memorizing. Memorize something. Memorize anything. Memorize Emerson. Memorize something because it's really great.
Well, so you're saying that the content does matter. That it's this churning of the mind.
Yes.
There are higher things that
yes.
can be churning and lower things.
Or correct application or incorrect application is more how I would put it. I would postulate, we're going to take like one or two more questions. I would postulate that Patanjali is touting a philosophy of consequentialism. There is no good quality and no bad quality. There's correct application of a quality and incorrect application of a quality, but then he has several things that are considered obstacles. For example, asmita. Asmita literally means I am-ness, right? It's considered to be one of the kleshas, one of the mental defilements that we actually didn't get to. it's considered to be a mental defilement, an obstruction, right? But it's also one of the stages of samadhi as well, right? This is really interesting. How can it be an obstruction to samadhi and a stage of samadhi at the same time? Well, you have to use the sense asmita, this I am-ness, this sense of separate self. You have to use that in the right application so it becomes the correct tool. This goes to our martial arts studying, right? A martial artist takes any situation and makes it a good situation. You know, somebody just punched me in the mouth and knocked out three of my teeth. I want to figure out how to make that situation into a good situation. This is a high skill in martial arts, right? This is the same thing that Patanjali is putting forward, the idea that there are no good, bad ways of thoughts, you know. Even anger can be used in a correct way, as Dr. King often spoke of, that he was angry, and he was righteous anger, right? Okay, I'm going to take one more question, then we're going to quit. Anybody else? Somebody argue with me, please.
Well, my teacher wrote, really, Mr. Iyengar.
Oh, yeah, you
he
can.
He wrote, cool. In light on my earlier, just think what you're talking about using anger, using ignorance,
yeah.
And his distinction between using it for good or not for good is if his ego is attached.
Exactly.
If he goes into class and he's blowing up, he's famous for yelling and hitting and students, and he says, but if I'm doing it out of my ego, that's wrong, that's violence. And if I'm doing it because I'm clearly saying that that's the kind of interaction this person needs, and my ego's not wrapped up in it, then it's true.
This is 100% correct. Whatever you're doing, however you're thinking, make sure it's transcending the separation between the people and the things and the chairs and the objects around you, and then it's used in a beneficial way, right? If it's created and enhanced in a sense of separation and ego, then it's counterproductive to the path.
Incorrect action.
Yeah, exactly. Am I going to take one more question? Okay, banal.
Okay, well, how would you apply some of this yoga?
He asked me this question in the car.
No, not actually different. To social movements of today.
All right. Well, we talked a lot about the implications of subordinating theology to mythology. That's like a larger, the idea of universalism, that there's a grain of truth or a seed of truth, I should say, in all religions, and that they can be held and tolerant of each other. We talked about that. And then also what this is fundamental is, Jim and I were speaking the other day, he asked me about ahimsa. Ahimsa is the very first, out of all the path that Patanjali lays out, the very first thing he says is ahimsa, which is nonviolence, right? This is essential. As long as you commit an act of violence, you are, like you say, creating a sense of ego. You're like, I'm going to benefit at the expense of you. This is the fundamental principle of violence. I'm benefiting at the expense of you, right? So the very essence of the yogic path is ahimsa, is nonviolence. It's more like, I'm going to do whatever I can to benefit you, right? So yoga has a fundamental social implication in that regard, is that you're putting other people's needs equal, if not before your own, okay? Alright. I think we're done. Okay. All right. Thanks. I have my information if you guys are interested. And also, I would like to get some sign your name and emails if you guys are interested in any future.
We can put a piece of paper on the counter there, which we often do.
Lovely, lovely. I teach workshops, I teach classes, and I also would like to do many more of these kind of lectures. So if you're interested, please.
I wish you'd come back and finish this one.
Oh, this is. I was going to say, why don't you come back and do a few more sutras, and then a few more, and we'll. I think people would enjoy it.
Yeah. Well, I would ultimately like to start a series of classes, maybe have a 10-class series. If that is well attended, then I would like to have an ongoing sutra study where we learn the sutras.
Or you can,
I have two of my students here who have actually I'm teaching the sutras to.
Or you could take people on an all-night hike and recite the entire sutra.
And eat Baker's chocolate and drink green tea. Yeah, we had that experience, actually. Ultimately, I would like to turn this into a study group and spend half hour discussing the sutras, half hour meditating, applying the teaching of the sutra to meditation. So,
but we'll talk about future events, so stay tuned. Thank you so much. You brought great energy to a wonderful subject, and we're very appreciative.
Thank you for this.
Thank you all for coming tonight. I want to point out a couple of things very, very quickly.
We have a donation bowl. The Buddhist practice of dana is dear to our hearts, and we split the dana with the speakers, and the other half goes to support the space in which these events happen. So we encourage you to be generous there. And we hope you'll come back and visit us again, both when Kogan comes back, and which we hope will be soon, and also to satisfy your holiday needs for the upcoming season. So thank you all for coming tonight, and have a great evening.
Hey, if you guys want to talk to me and ask me any questions,